What I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful.
Patricia T. O'Connor joins me now. She visits the show once a month to talk about the English language, and we take your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also communicate with us through our comments page. And in case you don't know, Pat O'Connor is the author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, Woe Is I, Jr., and co-author of You Send Me. That's four books, and I assume there's a fifth in the works.
Yes, there is, which I'm not working on today.
But I guess words will never fail you when it comes to talking about the language.
Oh, you'd be surprised. I sit there chewing my pencil a lot.
Oh, do you? Well, as long as listeners call in with really interesting questions, there are always things to be discussed.
Yes.
And the last time you were here, somebody asked us about Ola. We know about gate and some of the other things get attached to words.
Uh-huh.
How did Ola get attached to words? And as we talked about it, we kept on going further and further back. Payola, Crayola,
uh-huh.
Pianola.
Uh-huh.
How far back did you find out it really goes?
Well, actually, Ola began, it doesn't have any particular meaning. I think it just began as an arbitrary suffix because it sounded nice, and it made its first appearance just as an arbitrary part of a neologism in the 1870s in the word granola. Did you know it was around back then?
No, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, well, granola was the original grape nuts.
Oh, really?
Eventually, it became marketed as grape nuts, but that's was its original name.
What about canola, the oil? Is that a
canola,
late name,
or
is that just
a late one? Mm-hmm. That's a late one, and another early one is pianola,
mm-hmm.
which was so successful it almost became the generic word for a player piano, and of course Victrola, and that was 1905, and pianola 1900. And this Ola business was so successful, people seemed to trust products with Ola in them, that by the end of 1928, there were 98 registered trade names containing Ola. And there was, of course, Shinola, which was the butt of so many jokes, Crayola, Moviola, and Editola. A lot of these were in the music and film and radio industries, and then Motorola in 1930.
Oh, but, so the corporation took on an Ola to be part of this movement?
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And actually, payola was, it goes way back, too. It was originally a Tin Pan Alley term from the 1920s, meaning a paying act.
Oh, so it was positive, because I wondered,
positive.
All
it
these other Olas have a positive thing to them, but then payola is a negative thing.
Well, it wasn't so negative when it first popped up. Words in Ola were common in showbiz slang back then. Words like bafola, flopola could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
Cuffola meant something off the cuff. We don't hear that one anymore. But it was natural. It was natural that when a phenomenon came along that involved people, you know, an act paying for airtime or paying to be part of a stage review, it was called payola. And it wasn't necessarily, it didn't have the bribery connotations or the graft connotations that it does now. That didn't come along until the word was revived in the 60s during the disc jockey scandals.
So whoever came up with the name granola started something.
Exactly. I guess it was the Kellogg people, or I'm guessing.
Well, I don't think grape nuts is
Kellogg. Grape nuts was Post, but supposedly they stole the formula. Now, I read this in American Speech. I'm not sure if it's the legalities are all
correct. Because Kellogg's, as
correct,
far as I know, was just cornflakes initially.
Well, they did have this granola product that resembled grape nuts. And supposedly, C.W. Post stayed at the Kellogg Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, and stole the formula and whatnot. Don't
the
quote
rest
me
is
on
history.
That one. Yes.
The rest is Ola. And then, of course, people, Spanish-speaking people, say Ola when they answer the phone. I think that's probably something quite different.
Well, I think it's interesting that Ola is both pejorative and this sort of wholesome suffix, because when Mazola oil was named, or Mazola margarine in the 60s, they chose that Ola thing, and they marketed themselves as being made of golden American corn. You know, it had that there. It was a wholesome marketing device. So Ola was positive.
Well, this is all about inventing words, mm-hmm. and some things stick and some don't.
Right.
I got an email recently about a new word that I've been seeing in newspapers, I guess, because it's a new word and it got a little bit of attention, that I don't think I'll ever catch on. Is it locavore?
Locavore.
Vore.
Like herbivore or carnivore, only locavore.
And who do locavores, do locavores eat?
Locavores eat local foods. Or things produced within a certain distance from their homes, from where it's consumed. And this word was only invented a couple of years ago, and it's been named the word of the year by the New Oxford American Dictionary.
I believe in eating locally, but I'm not sure I'm going to say I'm a locavore.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much that's going to catch on. But, you know, some of those word of the year things catch on and some of them don't. But it's a phenomenon in itself, the whole word of the year business, because it's become a small industry for dictionary companies, and you can see why. It's great publicity. Someone announces word of the year, and everyone covers it. And, for example, the Webster's New World College Dictionary has chosen as its word of the year a phrase, grass station, which is a play on gas station, and it's a pun about vegetable-based fuels. Well, I can't see that one catching on either. I could be wrong.
Maybe if they stuck olas at the end of both of them.
Grass station ola.
Yeah, locavorola.
Merriam-Webster's word of the year is even weirder, I think. It's woot, W-O-O-T, but the O's in the middle are not the letter O, they are zeros, and it is a word in the online gaming community. Mm. It's sort of like, yay!
Woot.
They say woot. It's an acronym of we owned the other team. W-O-O-T, and the O's are zeros. They like to make words out of numbers. That one, I think, is going to sink into obscurity, too. But there's another contest coming up. The whole Word of the Year thing was started in 1990 by the American Dialect Society, and it's going to be naming its Word of the Year in January. And they have a couple of good nominations. At least I think they might stick. One is bacon, spelled B-A-C-N, with no other O. And it's like spam, except that it's stuff that you might want to save. Bacon, yeah. And another one is Gorno, which is a movie that's gory to the point of being fetishistic. It's a combination of gore and porno.
Mm. Well, porno gets used to some, or porn gets attached to so many things.
Yeah,
now, food porn and this kind of porn, uh-huh. and that kind of porn.
Uh-huh.
Are we debasing good old-fashioned dirty movies by applying it? Or should we call it pornola? And
pornola, that, or gorola, for gory but wholesome movies. I think we could get into this racket, you know?
I want us to come up with our own word of the year. Because I don't like any of those.
Oh, well, I'll think about it. Maybe we can come up with one for next time.
Yeah, I think we'll be back in January, and uh-huh. maybe we can announce the Patricia O'Connor Leonard Lopate Word of the Year.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Maybe I'll be in touch.
That was a couple of years back. Let's do lunch. 212-433-9692 is our number. And we invite your calls. Should we take some calls?
Yes.
Let's go to John from Paramus.
How you doing?
Okay.
Good. Happy holidays to all. I always feel my questions are not up to snuff after listening to her opening monologue. Anyway.
But snuff, that's an interesting word.
which is
yeah, I wonder why would something be up to snuff? Snuff is something you snort, right?
Yeah. Now,
so
where
why
does
would
that
something
come
be up
from?
To snuff?
That's not my question, but that's...
Oh, okay.
What is up to snuff? Yeah. Well, I guess snuff goes up, so that's why. So, anyway.
Oh, that's right. It does. It goes up your nose.
Or, yeah, up your nose or up your cheek. Or they put it in your cheek, too.
Oh, well, that's right.
on the lip or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I never did snuff.
Okay, what's your question? We're going to forget
let me think about this for a moment. Maybe something not being up to snuff means it's just not as powerful as snuff.
Yeah, it's not just
it exciting. Doesn't make you sneeze.
Yeah, it doesn't do the job the way snuff would do the job.
It doesn't give you the charge or the...
Yeah.
Well, anyway, what is the origin of... What is a Yule? As in Yule log. What is Yule? Where did that come from?
Oh, I think it comes from an... Oh, go ahead, Leonard.
I think it's way back in Old English or something. Probably a totally different word that... Because it sounds like one of those
yeah,
words
that... Yeah, I think it comes from an ancient root, the one that gave us wheel, if I'm not mistaken.
Wheel, yeah.
I should have boned up on my Christmas stuff before coming here, but I didn't.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I didn't mean to play stump the band or anything.
It comes from Middle English yol, or from Old English geol. And it means a season or a feast celebrating a season.
Oh, so that's why they burnt the Yule log.
Yeah.
I wonder if gala has any kind of connection to that, because that's a seasonal
feast kind of thing. That's a good point. Yeah, that may be true.
Although that may also come out of Latin. It gets so complicated.
I know, Pat.
I know.
And there are some things even in Old English that come from Latin, which you wouldn't think would be possible. But
because it was cross-fertilization or because first of all, the Romans did conquer England. And were there for quite a while, I would have assumed that a fair number of words would have remained.
Yeah, it looks like gala doesn't come from there.
Well, it was a thought.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call. And we go now to Drew. Hi, Drew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what do you want to talk about?
I have a question about verb forms of names. Now, for example, like Sigmund Freud's expression would be Freudian, I-A-N at the end,
mm-hmm.
whereas Franz Kafka's would be Kafka-esque,
mm-hmm.
U-U-E.
And now Marx would be Marxist.
Right. So then, and I think there's more that I just can't think of, but I wanted to know how many there were and what defines what name gets what ending.
There are exactly 3,270. Actually, I don't know how many there are, but almost anyone's name can become an adjective. And I think I've seen Marxian and Marxist. And I think the one that survives is just the one that proves most popular or easier to say or sounds nicest.
Well, I think the ist is interesting because a Marxist is somebody who follows the ideas of Marx. A sadist is somebody who practices the sorts of things that the Marquis de Sade wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't say a Freudist because... And I'm not sure exactly why. I understand why Kafka-esque, because esque really has to do with kind of a style of or in a sensibility
of. Yeah, some suffixes have little hints, shades of difference.
It seems that the S comes after vowel endings.
Yeah.
Not always humoresque.
E-N.
Or E-N?
I think I-A-N can sometimes come after... At the end of a, like the vowel part being deleted. I can't think of one at the moment. I think it's just whatever's easily pronounceable and sounds right.
And maybe it's like Ola. Somebody just added it at a certain point, and that's what we wound up with. I remember reading, I think, an argument over whether we should say egoist or egotist. And by all theories, egoist would be better than egotist, and yet most people would say egotist and egotistical. I don't know if anybody says egoistical.
No, but, well, actually, I have seen egoistical, and those two words now have branched off slightly, so they have slightly different meanings, egoist and egotist. An egotist being a person who is egotistical, and an egoist being a person who believes in individualism, that kind of thing. I may have screwed that up. You may be right.
Well,
yeah, once in a while somebody sends in a question about that, and I have to look it up all over again.
Well, thank you so much for your call, and we'll take a little break and come back with more from Patricia T. O'Connor and you. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Stay with us. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, who has written a number of books on the language. Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, written with her husband, the only one she's collaborated on. And then she went back to her own stuff again with Woe Is I, Jr., Language for Kids. And she visits us once a month, and we take your calls at 212-433-9692. Not just take your calls, but also, in some cases, your comments, your little questions to our comments page. And I pass one over to you that you think is a really interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah, someone asks, actually, John from New Jersey asks, what does the phrase Read the Riot Act mean? What is the Riot Act? Does it have anything to do with filibustering in the Senate? Actually, I like this question because it's so seldom that someone asks a question that you can answer that there really is a literal explanation. And in this case, there really was something called the Riot Act. In the early 18th century in England, there was a lot of civil strife and whatnot, and the Parliament passed a law preventing a lot of people from assembling and forming an unruly crowd. And the act was that more than a dozen or so people shouldn't congregate in the streets. And if a dozen or so, or 14, were found congregating and milling around in the streets, a constable or whatever, an officer of the law, could come and read them a portion of the Riot Act, the one that said if they didn't disperse within an hour, they could be arrested or suffer whatever penalties. And so that's what reading the Riot Act was about.
Wow.
Okay. Totally literal explanation, which doesn't always happen in language.
Yeah, usually it's some kind of a tortured thing. Rachel from Washington Heights, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just have a comment about Woot because I've been gaming online for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
It actually started off as either a shortening of woohoo or a typo for woof, but it doesn't actually mean anything.
Oh.
We Own the Other Team is an example of a backronym where,
oh,
you know, there's a word that, you mm-hmm. know, people then fill in another meaning, like the programming language Perl, which had its 20th birthday yesterday, later got tagged with the backronym Pathologically Eclectic Rubbish Lister.
Oh. So people just came up with We Own the Other Team to explain Woot, but it really didn't mean that originally.
No, it's just like pwned, you know, P-W-N-E-D. It's just a typo, you know, that, you know, for owned mm-hmm. that became popular.
Ah.
So I don't know whether it actually started off as woof or a shortening of woohoo, but the, but We On Our Other Team has nothing to do with it.
Gee, when I type poorly, nobody says, hey, let's,
let's
use that
a
as a new word.
Yeah.
There are some, thank you for spell check, although that's another weird thing. Have you noticed that spell check can be so ungrammatical? I've decided sometime to take some famous work of literature and then put it through the Bill Gates spell check and see what comes out. I'm sure it'll be stunningly weird.
Oh, yes, yes.
Let's take some more calls. And Pete from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, there's a word I'm hearing lately, brawlic, and I believe you'd spell it B-R-A-W-L-I-C.
Mm.
And it seems to borrow some meaning from brawl and some meaning from brawny. And I hear kids using it to describe someone who's tough-looking and sort of inclined to fight. I've been hearing it for two years or so.
And it ends in I-C, brawlic?
Yeah, it's like turning brawl into an adjective.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's new on me, but if you send it in to the people at the New Oxford Dictionary, maybe they'll make it
next
word
year.
Of the year.
Gotcha.
Thank
gotcha.
You so much for calling
Thank
us.
You.
We got a number of comments from listeners about Yule. One says Yule, spelled J-U-L, but pronounced the same, is the word for Christmas in Norwegian, Swedish, and Danish, even today. And another, now I don't know if this is, whether this is true or not true, because didn't find it in the dictionary, but this listener says that Yule is derived from a Viking term for wheel. You mentioned that earlier. The celebration honored winter solstice as the passing of another year, which was likened to the metaphorical turning of the wheel, the year, like a wheel made another turn.
Mm-hmm.
And that may or may not be true. And we
go now.
It
makes a lot of sense.
What do you think?
I think it makes a lot of sense.
We go now to Barbara. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I love your commentary, Patricia. I wonder what is happening to the language. Separate out. Why do we need out? Wilt down on all the cooking programs. Of course it wilts down. It can't wilt up.
Mm-hmm.
Reflect back. But the re gives you the back. What mm-hmm. is going on? This is all over.
Actually, someone brought another one to my attention the other day that's been around for a while. Change out.
Oh.
Meaning to replace, like you change out your spark plugs.
Oh.
I think people seem to like prepositions. And when a word starts to lose some of its strength, we think we can beef it up a little bit by adding a preposition to it.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but that does make sense. But it drives me crazy. I want to scream at the radio or the TV every time this happens.
But you make a point there, Pat, that I've noticed in general with the way people use language. At a certain point, they feel that the word itself, like unique, for example,
mm-hmm.
or great,
mm-hmm.
isn't enough. And so they have to say it's really
yeah.
unique, it's really great, as though
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the alternative is.
Right.
Not unique?
Or another one you find is something fell off of a truck.
Yes.
So you add an extra of.
A lot of those. What do you think that is?
I don't know. I think English is very rich in prepositions because we inherited prepositions from all kinds of different languages. So we have more than any other individual language. And we like to use them at every opportunity. Interestingly, when people who are learning English as a second language email me, often it's because they don't understand which preposition to use. Why do I turn the alarm off why does the alarm go off?
Mm-hmm. Instead of on, it really does go on.
I turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's hard. A lot of these things are idiomatic and it's hard to get a grasp of them.
And there are other examples. For example, many people who speak another language first say thanks God instead of thank God.
Well, they do. I hadn't heard that.
It's very common. And it's because I guess they don't understand that what we're really doing there is we're telling someone to thank God.
Uh-huh. You're using it as a verb
yes.
instead of thanks, as in
yes.
thanks be to God.
Yes.
Hmm.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. And Sheila, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a quick question about the proper pronunciation of P-A-T-I-N-A.
What do you think it is?
Well, I've always said patina, but I was corrected and told, no, it's patina. And I'd really like to know.
Yeah, I always said patina
yeah.
before I heard someone else talking and saying patina, and I looked it up and I found that either of them are all right. I'm not sure which one comes first. Yeah. I'm just checking with American Heritage right now. Let me see. It's, we don't want that. Partial birth abortion. Okay, sorry.
Patina has partial
I think,
birth?
No, sorry, I was on the wrong page.
But this is often the case with words. There are two different pronunciations, mm-hmm. and then there are people who insist that mm-hmm. you use one
exactly.
rather
mm-hmm.
than another when both are a possibility.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hate being corrected when I'm right, unfortunately.
Okay, patina mm-hmm. is first and then patina.
So patina is first.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Okay.
In fact, if I looked in another dictionary, it might be different. When two words appear just separated by a comma, or two pronunciations, I mean, mm-hmm. after an entry, it means that either one is correct and there may be no significant difference between them at all.
But that's when there's a comma. What about when
sometimes
there's
it says or?
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean that the second one is slightly less common. Or it might say also patina, also patina.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean the also is significantly less common. But dictionaries, again, they do this differently. So you have to check the front part of your dictionary for where the variants are discussed.
This listener writes in asking about, it says spit and image, often referred to as spitting image. Now, I've never heard spit and image. I always thought it was spitting image.
Actually, spit and image is closer to
the original?
The original derivation. We've been saying spitten, S-P-I-T-T. Well, spitten image was, that's also been in there. But this is a complicated one. It seems that in way back in medieval times, to someone's spit was supposed to represent a likeness. In other words, you would say he's so like his father, he is the spit of his father. I know it's a little bit gross.
Well, but it's a DNA kind of a thing before anybody knew there was DNA.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't want to look too closely. this is a little bit messy, this explanation, but it really does come from spit. It doesn't come from spirit and image, which some people have suggested. It's really spit.
Thank you for your call. Bob from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You mentioned that you may come up with, you guys might come up with your own word of the year.
We're open to suggestion, though.
Well, I immediately came up with an idea for a word that would describe an especially wholesome idea that arrived at by you and Leonard working together.
Yeah, what's that?
It would be something that would be very petropate.
Patropate.
Patropate.
Patropate, yes.
I like it.
Okay. we'll start calling this the Patropate segment. we'd have to use your last name if we're going to use my last name, wouldn't we?
Yeah, but it might, it's always...
Unless we'd be hoisted by our own Petnard.
Well, we could say Low Connor.
Uh huh.
Using both of our last names.
There are all sorts of possibilities. Aren't there? I think we're going to abandon that. Our number 212-433-9692. I gave you a couple of other suggestions from listeners who have written in.
Yes. Now here's one, and this one I don't know, but I have a feeling there are people out there who will. The person is saying. And this call is from Peekskill. My mother used to say, boy, that will lay you out in lavender.
I never heard that.
Did they mean lavender satin lining for a coffin, or did they use lavender in funerals to diffuse the odors? I have a feeling that laying someone out in lavender really did probably mean laying him out in lavender in a coffin filled with lavender, not the satin lining, but... I know that herbs were often buried with people, aromatic herbs. So that would be my guess. But I wonder if there's anyone out there perhaps in the funeral industry.
Yeah, that's probably is there an undertaker in the house, so to speak?
Yeah.
Our number, if you are an undertaker or know the answer, is 212-433-9692. And Lauren from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Leonard, for all that you do. And for this segment particularly, I'm hoping fervently for your support concerning the phrase to beg the question. In recent, very recent years, with increasing frequency, including PR and I think WNYC and news journals, I'm seeing it used to mean to pose the question. I think it means the opposite, to avoid the question.
Oh, no, it doesn't actually mean to avoid the question either. It
doesn't.
It doesn't either mean either to raise it or to pose it or to bring it up or to make it moot. What it means is to raise an argument in such a way that the foundation of the argument the statement that you're using to posit your argument is itself in need of proving, which shows you why the original meaning of the expression is obscure. I think it's justifiably obscure. Nobody knows that anymore.
That's a very authoritative answer.
Well, I've been asked it so many times. I've done a lot of checking into it, and it's sort of like, Brian Garner, who's a usage expert, uses as an example of an argument that begs the question is, life is, let me see, I better not bring that up. It involves abortion, which is a subject.
We're back to it. This is a subtext of this whole segment that we've been doing.
I know.
A secondary theme.
But here's one. Just the purely religious begging the question one. God must exist because he is perfection, and it would be an imperfection not to exist. That's begging the question. That's using something that, you know, haven't proved your opening statement.
We will see you again on the 16th next year. Wow.
Yeah.
January 16th. And if people want to reach you, they can reach you at your website. You want to give it to them?
Yeah. It's mailbox@grammarphobia.com. If you want to ask me any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
And you also have a blog called grammarphobia.com?
It's at mailbox, at grammarphobia.com.
Thank you so much, Patricia T. O'Connor.
Okay, thanks.
On tomorrow's show, why the media have largely ignored some troubling business dealings in Rudolph Giuliani's past, also the life and 50-year career of actress Joan Blondell, Chris Elliott on his new novel, and on Underreported, why current sex offender laws in the United States may not be working. By the way, Christmas is just a week away, and if you need any cookie ideas, check out the results of our recent holiday cookie recipe swap. It's on our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Stephen Valentino, and Leslie Dickstein. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.